This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580, The Information Advantage. I'm Bill Hammack, substituting for Celeste Quinn. Now, usually you only hear me for a few minutes on Tuesday mornings talking about engineering and life, but today I take a deeper look at the relationship between science, technology, and photography. My guest today is the author of a book entitled Envisioning Science, and it's chock full of fascinating images of scientific experiments in action, close-up views of crystals and flowing liquids and reflected lights that give us a whole new perspective on science. And today we'll talk about how my guest created these photos and, above all, why she creates them. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or if you're anywhere else, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. So let's welcome to the Afternoon Magazine Felice Frankel.
Hi, Bill. Wonderful to be with you. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Well, Felice, we have you at something of a disadvantage here, and that we're on radio, and what you do, of course, is very visual. So I wondered if you could describe to our listeners what kind of scientific things you photograph. Maybe give us three or four examples.
You're very brave to have me. And you're absolutely right. It's one of the frustrations. And it's also frustrating because I'm a photographer. I'm not a word person. Mm-hmm. So for me to describe what I do is really putting me on the line. But let me just say that in if I can get to the point briefly, what I try to do is capture what is going on in various laboratories, mostly at MIT, but at other places as well. In material science, in nanotechnology, that's a kind of a buzzword, in biology and physics, all those things that are, in fact, photographable somehow. But the important piece that I'd like to think I add is not being afraid to include the beauty of that is already there. I'm not making these pictures. I'm not making science beautiful. I am revealing what is already there in the research, and I'd like to think eventually I'm making it more accessible to the public. That's one of my primary goals.
Mm-hmm. So what are the kind of things that in your book, Envisioning Science, a listener would see?
Well, we can see something that we could see a yeast colony, for example. Now, why in the world would we want to look at a yeast colony? Mm-hmm. Well, this particular yeast colony, for example, out of Jerry Fink's lab at MIT's Whitehead Institute, is growing in the form of a flower. It literally looks like a flower. It is absolutely stunning. We're not quite sure why it's doing that. But that is one pretty large picture. And then we can go to the other extreme, and we could look at a detail of a micro rotor. It's a little piece of a machine that is fabricated in our laboratories here that is eventually going to be an engine behind a small airplane. So you literally are looking at all sorts of scales, all sorts of material. We can also see in the book nanowires. These are wires that Jerry Lieber basically constructed, if we could say that, on a scale that we can't even use a camera. We have to use electrons to look at it. And I work with people who are better at it than I am, that is using those electrons to make pictures. But what I do is I ask them to do various things and capture it in a way that I would think works better.
So in the case of the micromotor, just to give our listeners a feel for it, we're talking about a little motor that's less than a half inch total size, right?
Exactly.
I mean, around that.
And then you could see the blades, which is less than a millimeter, if that makes sense to people. So, yes, we're looking at very, very small things and even smaller than that. That actually is considered a macro level. So we talk about all sorts of scales in the book.
Now, in the book, you emphasize scientific images and you stress making them compelling. And I wanted to know why this is important. You mentioned one already, that is, there's a public interest to have really a culturally rich, science-loving society, is a way to put it. But what other reasons are there to have compelling scientific images?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the direction that science is heading as well. We are becoming interdisciplinary in our research. The biologists scientists are working with the physicists. Mm-hmm. The chemists are working with the material scientists. Sometimes it's very difficult to make the distinction. And because of this very, very exciting time of our research, we have to start talking to each other. And I think that it's in the images that is a kind of a nice beginning. But just as important, and this is, frankly, a little bit of a harder sell, unless mm-hmm. you've kind of done it, but when you make pictures, when you you actually make pictures for the purpose of communication, not just for your own notebook, but in order to tell a story, to give information to other people, you have to be clearer in your own mind about what you want to say in that picture or in that figure. And in the process, you become clearer about the science that you're mm-hmm. thinking about, because I really do see it when I am nudging our students here to go to a picture that is better than good enough. And I do think that it's a form of clarifying the ideas.
So really there's two things for the scientists that this really does. One is to give them a common vocabulary, which is an image. So in an interdisciplinary interaction, we're not caught up in the various languages that they have.
Absolutely.
And you're saying that the scientists themselves, when they are looking at their results in a different way and trying to communicate a story with a photo, actually look at their work a little bit differently. Is there a specific example of when that happened?
Well, one of the images that really kind of got me going on this whole new world for myself about 11 years ago was when I started this whole thing in George Whiteside's lab. At that point, I was at Harvard on a fellowship.
And who's George Whiteside?
George Whiteside is mm-hmm. a prominent chemist. Actually, he just won the Kyoto Prize, which mm-hmm. is a very prestigious prize. He's somebody who, he's called a chemist, but he works in all sorts of areas, in material science and biology as well. And George is, he kind of gave me the nudge to move with this stuff. He said, you know, you're on to something. And what happened was I basically invited myself to his laboratory during this fellowship. I actually didn't know who he was, but he was lecturing, and he was obviously very visual in how he presented his work.
So you were at Harvard, though, on a fellowship with the Graduate School of Design.
Yes.
Because of other photography that you had done.
Right. In fact, that was what I was not in science any longer. I started in science after graduating from college and became an assistant in laboratory, left science for about 20 years and became an architectural and landscape architectural photographer mm-hmm. and did very well with that. I totally untrained, of course. You understand, none of this is formal. Mm-hmm. And I did publish a book called Modern Landscape Architecture with Jory Johnson, who used to be out there, and was given this wonderful Loeb Fellowship where I could do anything I wanted to do. Can you imagine as an mm-hmm. adult to go to Harvard? I mean, it's a true gift. Mm-hmm. So I found myself sitting in on every science class I could put my hands on, and George was teaching a class in molecular biology. Again, as I say, he was very visual. I invited him myself to his lab. He showed me the stuff that he was doing. Nick Abbott, one of his postdocs, submitted a paper to Science, and it was accepted. And I looked at their pictures, and I said, these are lousy. I really think we could do something better. And so what it was at that point was patterning a surface with hydrophobic areas. That means water fearing, so that, for mm-hmm. example, when water hits that particular hydrophobic line, it stops. And so they were patterning areas on a very small scale, about 2 to 3 millimeter scale. And their pictures were, let's just say, not as clear as they could have been. Mm-hmm. And so by asking them to do this and that, and if I could do this, and if I could get the picture in focus, for example, mm-hmm. Maybe we could say something a little different. And we were saying exactly what they wanted to say, but we clarified it more. Because, for example, I asked them, what if we colored those drops of water? Let's say we color them before we put it on the surface, we can show that those drops do not blend together, which is the point of the chemistry. that those hydrophobic lines are preventing those drops to blend together. I'm sorry we can't see that, but I don't know if that's clear, but that was very exciting.
So with George Whitesides, you wrote a book called On the Surface of Things,
right,
which was a collection of photos, and it's rather an interesting book in that you make rust photogenic and oil slicks also. What was in that book?
Well, the idea in the book, for the book, was to have a very accessible vocabulary for the public, for them to look at an image that they don't necessarily see as science, and for George to write beautifully, as he does, about what is the science in the pictures. So it is about introducing the general public to the fact that everything around them is science. It's just that they don't know it as such. I want to turn the world on to science. This is my small little soapbox that I'm standing on. I think it's not acceptable that intelligent people in our society accept scientific illiteracy. We have to become more engaged in the very important questions that are being asked. And I feel very deeply that communicating with a vocabulary that is accessible allows us to become more engaged. So the book was for the public to get them to understand that surfaces and all this stuff that happens on surfaces is very much about science.
So you worked with George Whitesides, who apparently was receptive to your work. How did other scientists react to it? Has this been a lot of effort to interest them in it, or did it take off right away?
It's a good question. At first, you can imagine, I got these weird looks. What does this woman want from us? You know, of course, at that point, I was then, after about a year, I then came over to MIT, just kind of beginning this idea. And initially, it was tough. But again, giving credit where it's due, the fact that George put his stamp of approval, to be very frank, and he doesn't do that often, opened up wonderful doors to me. And then in the end, what happened was that most of the people on campus started accepting this, if I can call it a service. And what I think is interesting is I think this only could have happened at MIT. It sounds hyperbolic to say that, but MIT is filled with incredibly smart and generally, there's always an exception, generally intellectually secure people. Mm-hmm. And I believe that a new idea like this, and it is fairly new, there's no one, unfortunately, kind of doing this. There are a lot of people who do beautiful work in their laboratories or in a particular field, but nobody's doing it generically, you know, like a journalist does. So the sense of security on campus, frankly, I think allowed this to grow to what it has become. Now my fantasy, my hope, is to encourage younger people to actually create a profession like this. There should be, in my opinion, a science visualization journalist or communicator. I mean, I actually don't know what to call myself. But you can imagine the need for something like this, especially, again, because of the interdisciplinary nature of the work. And I think that it's a way of bringing people into our world that would never even consider looking at it.
This is Bill Hammack, and I'm talking with Felice Frankel. She is artist in residence at MIT, and we're talking about her scientific photographs, which have appeared in Scientific American, Discover magazine, and have been exhibited at museums around the world. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or if anywhere else, please call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Now, Felice, I did say you were artist in residence, and maybe your title has changed there.
Yes, I'm glad you picked up on that. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is it research scientist now?
Yes, and actually, it's not trivial that happened.
Mm-hmm.
I started off as an artist in residence in the Edgerton Center. I'm very grateful to Kim Vandiver for making that happen.
And the Edgerton Center is where the strobe photographs originated.
Doc mm-hmm. Edgerton, exactly, yes. Mm-hmm. What happened was the powers that be felt that the work was no longer relevant to the artist in residency program. And this is one of these interesting issues because many people have heard me say this until they get bored to death, but I don't consider myself an artist. Mm-hmm. I consider myself a visual communicator. Although some of the work might look like art, in fact, some people hang them in their offices, but that was a place of separation for us because I felt very deeply that the content of the pictures I make is more important than the aesthetics. And so for that reason, I was gently asked to remove myself from the artist in residency program. Luckily, I have wonderful friends on this campus, researchers who felt, oh my God, you know, we better do something. So mm-hmm. Bob Silby, my dean of science, found a slot to make me what we are calling a research scientist. Mm-hmm. Whatever you call me, it doesn't matter. It's just it's the point of what I'm trying to do.
Sure. And Felice, I want to explore a little bit in just a second why you don't call yourself an artist. But we have a caller on line one right now. Caller, line one, please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. I heard about a book, and, you know, I don't know very much about it. It was written in the 30s. Maybe it sounds, the gist of it sounds sort of like what your guest is interested in. It was called Mathematics for the Millions. Have you heard of this, Bill?
Yes. Okay. Go ahead.
And my understanding of it, it was sort of written by these sort of East Coast radical intelligentsia. The notion of the book was that it wasn't supposed to be a textbook as such. It was just supposed to be a book available to folks to explain math for the millions. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of, I was wondering if you could talk about that. And it sort of sounds like what your guest is interested in. It sort of sounds like the intent is the same.
Felice, well, maybe we'll return. I think it's relevant about why you don't call yourself an artist. You're really interested in communicating ideas in science and documenting what goes on in the lab. And to you, I think the pictures are part of the result.
Yes.
You once said, and I quote you here, "I don't relate to the contemporary art scene in any way," end quote. Why is that?
Yes, okay, that's good for you for digging that out. And I got a number of letters, very angry letters.
Yeah, perhaps I should apologize for digging that out, but go ahead.
No, I'm very impressed, actually. I think the difference between me and the artist, I am not trying to represent myself in any of the work. It's personal, certainly, for me when I do it. But I am not, hopefully, in the picture. It's the science that is in the picture. It's very much about something other than myself. For the most part, at least my experience with artists, and believe me, I don't mean this in any condescending way. Mm-hmm. It's just different. But artists, that's what they are about, is trying to represent who they are somehow, mm-hmm. either conceptually or literally. But for me, it's not about me. So if my intention is to represent the science, and if we can define the final product by what the intention of the creator is, then it cannot be art, because I don't consider it art.
Mm-hmm. So there is a mild comment about the contemporary art scene that they're more interested in themselves and in personal statements than in communicating broader or larger issues. Am I hearing that correctly?
It's hardly mild. I'm saying that very forthrightly.
All right.
But yes, and that's I suppose it did get some people angry, but I do feel that way, and I'd love to be shown differently, to tell you the truth.
Felice, we have a caller in Urbana on line two. Line two, please go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Yes, please go ahead.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I've read the book your guest wrote with Whiteside. Like it a lot, and I'll have to look for a new one. Some connections are coming up in my mind that I wonder if you've considered them. I know you're a photographer, but the bigger issue is visual communication of science. One connection would be Donald Knuth, the mathematician and computer scientist who invented the typesetting program for math, science, and engineering, and has written beautiful books that are extremely well laid out, and I'm sure he considers that part of the, you know, the content rather than just an aesthetic thing. Then there's Edward Tufte. On the covers of one of his books, he took a visualization that was done here at NCSA and prettied it up, in addition to making it more dense in terms of content. And we also have president of local company Wolfram Research. His name's Steve Wolfram, who...
He just yeah, gave a talk here.
That book is, yeah, it's an incredible tour de force of visual communication. Whether scientists like that much or not, I'm not sure. But, you know, their visualizations of his computer programs, which he thinks are better models of reality than mathematics. So if you'd like to comment on those three connections and whether you see the common cause as well.
Felice, the first gentleman, he mentioned Donald Kunz, I think invented LaTeX, if I remember right, which is a typesetting program. I'm sure some caller will call if I'm wrong. So has things like typography influenced your
Absolutely.
Work?
Absolutely. And in fact, I'm delighted the caller raised all of these names because actually I've had conversations with Donald Knuth when he was here for about a week. I'm using the words we because what has happened is I have gone I'm certainly not leaving photography, but I have become completely absorbed in other forms of visually expressing ideas. And so this whole notion of explaining data visually is something I'm deeply involved with right now. In fact, we're now beginning making plans for the next Image and Meaning conference at MIT. We developed a conference 2 years ago where we invited architects, graphic artists, typographers, cartographers. We had an extraordinary 3-day event where we would start talking to each other about how to visually express science. Now, of course, so much of science is not visualizable, and so for that reason, I can be out of a job very quickly. And frankly, I find it incredibly exciting to find those kinds of vocabularies in the unphotographable. And so I'm very deeply involved right now in gathering the right kind of people together to have these kinds of discussions, certainly in computational biology, for example, in quantum mechanics. My gosh, how do we even begin to express these amazingly complicated things? Tufte did something very important.
If I could interrupt you, this is the author of the Visual Display of Quantitative Information and also the author of a book called Envisioning...
Information.
Yeah, right. Envisioning Science is your book.
Yes. Right. So, I think he's a little ticked that I use the word envisioning, I've been told. But, okay, so Tufte, I have to say, started something very important. He started a conversation. He started alerting us to the fact that there is a way of visually expressing ideas. But his books are basically, I'm not saying but, I shouldn't say that. I should say his books are a collection of other people's work and a very valuable collection. What we're trying to do with this conference and in our conversations among the researchers is to find those standards and those rules and the beginnings of how we could do all this. It's very important to see how other people have done it, which is what he's done. But now let's try to find a way of approaching it, and that is kind of the next step, I think, that we all have to entertain at this point.
So, in general, what you really want to do is communicate a scientific fact with your photographs, not just an aesthetic experience. So the question comes up then, what are the limits in, for lack of a better word, monkeying with pictures?
Yeah, very important point you're raising, and I discuss it in the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to manipulate images. It has always been there, by the way. A lot of people now are talking about we have to be so careful now because digitally manipulating images has become easier and easier. Well, you know, all images have been manipulated, haven't they? The very fact that you compose an image a certain way is a subjective decision. The very subject that you are photographing is subjective. So you could get a little crazy with this notion of it being pure. Certainly Ansel Adams, you know, worked very hard in the darkroom to create those extraordinary images. And that's a clear manipulation. It's not that derogatory. But it is very important. And so the digital images now, yes, it is happening with that as well. But at least we need to talk about it. I'm not suggesting that we can't do any of it. I do think that some of the enhancing does allow us to see things that we wouldn't see without the enhancement. But the point I make in the book is that it should always be on our agenda to tell each other what we've done to a particular image or how we've constructed a particular figure.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, is it okay to change the color of an image? I mean, we're not going to get hard and fast rules here, but what are the kind of things that you've done that you then have to report about the image?
Yeah, very good. For example, one of the scanning electron micrographs I've made in the picture in the book that was taken with electrons, and when you make a picture with electrons, there is no color. So I decided when Scientific American asked me to do this series of images to artificially color it. Those particular images I colored in Photoshop just aesthetically to change things. I don't think it's made the image clearer or communicate more. It was just making it more engaging. However, every time I do anything like that, I always indicate that I do it. And I feel very strongly that researchers have to do that as well. I also feel, and then I promise to shut up for a minute, but I feel very strongly that the journals have to now take more responsibility in this. We should have a section in all of the journals on the methodology of how a particular image was made, because I will bet you that most of the images that are published started off as something else, that they were somehow tweaked just a little bit. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's wrong, and that's a conversation we could discuss forever, but we at least have to alert the viewer that something has happened to that image.
Felice, you spent many years as a landscape photographer, and you mentioned one of your books, Modern Landscape Architecture. And in that book, there is a lot of pictures of landscapes of Southern California. They're very impressive. They're hot, parched. They're glaring. They have no shade and comfort. Mm-hmm. In those, really, nature asserts itself. They're very austere photographs. And I see a lot of similarities with the things that you photograph that we mentioned on the small scale. So how has your knowledge of as a landscape photographer influenced your scientific photography?
Oh, what a wonderful question, Bill. And you've really done your homework.
That
book is out of print, and I just can't get hold of it anymore. I think what happened to me during those 20, 25 years of photographing the built landscape is that it was a beautiful training ground for me to understand form and understand the difficulties of creating a two-dimensional object, which is what a picture is, from three dimensions. It's about translating those three dimensions into a way that makes them, those forms, comprehensible. Not easy. I mean, that's one of the issues with the flatland, you know, that we are, in fact, supposedly seeing three dimensions, but they're not three dimensions. And so it was, without my knowing, it was an interesting training ground in terms of getting me to think that way.
I mean, did it allow you to see how things were arranged in a photograph?
Exactly. Exactly. You've just hit it on the head. It was, you know, here I'm looking at this glorious space, certainly with one of the images comes to my mind is Noguchi's California Scenario, which is an abstraction of the forms in California. And how in the world can we, you know, there's a fabulous three-dimensional area. How do we tell that story on a piece of film? But somehow one gets to that. And I hope, I'd like to think that I did that successfully. And that was a very interesting training ground for me to look at another kind of landscape, which is what science is.
Now, since this book, Envisioning Science, is really as much a manual as it is a beautiful guide to science, it's intended for a listener here that might well be working in their lab and want to photograph things in their lab. And you say the first step to a good science photograph is to understand flatland, which you mentioned a few minutes ago. What do you mean by flatland?
Right. At this issue of, you know, when I'm actually looking at the book for the first time in months, by the way, and I still like it.
Good.
And I'm looking at a picture, and the picture I made, and it is that yeast flower that I described before. That is not that's not a two-dimensional. It's not a page. It is a raised colony on a petri dish of agar. How does one go about showing that on a page, which is in fact flat?
Mm-hmm.
And that is the challenge when you're approaching any sort of photography, how to get the viewer to really get the sense of what's going on literally something that's two-dimensional.
So you have to allow the viewer to look at the photo and fairly quickly sort out these different levels and depths, and the three-dimensional structure has to pop out at them.
Exactly.
Well, what happens to a first-time viewer, though, when they see a photograph versus you who have been studying it through the aperture for quite a while? Does a first-time viewer see it differently?
Wonderful, wonderful point you're raising. And, in fact, that's kind of the premise to the whole book, in that I'm trying to teach the researchers and the future science photographers that we have to keep in mind what the first-time viewer is going to see in our images. We cannot assume that they're going to go right to the point that we want them to go to. You know, we've been living with this science for years. We know what we want to look at. We have the ability to edit out all this stuff that is unimportant.
Mm-hmm.
But the first-time viewer has no clue where to look. And that is, in fact, one of the things I'm trying to teach here, how to engage a viewer on the journey, that the visual journey that we want them to take in our images. And really, one of the keys behind that, in my opinion, is to edit it like crazy. Just get out everything that's not relevant in your image.
And you mean edit it when you're setting it up, how close you place the camera, how
yes.
you frame the photo.
Composition and all that, exactly.
So really, understanding flatland is understanding the art of composition and how that translates into three dimensions for the viewer.
Wonderful.
So one of your other rules for making good photographs, well, you have some very practical ones, like use a fresh sample, which seem obvious.
But it does seem obvious.
I gather that since you had it in there, it's not obvious at all, is it?
Exactly. You got it.
I think you say use ones that aren't scratched and beaten and other things.
But, little things like that, which are, you know, it's almost so silly to mention it, but you would be surprised at some of the attempts some of these younger people making pictures.
Mm-hmm.
But another thing, for example, there's an image I made of Munji Buwendi's vials. It's a series of vials, containers, that have in it various colored material. We could just kind of leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
But the colored material is exactly what we want the viewer to look at. We don't want them to look at the containers. So when they first gave me this stuff, they gave me seven different containers.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't understand at that point that if I were to photograph these seven containers, nobody would look at the color, which is what we want people to look at in this picture.
Mm-hmm.
All we want them to see is the change of color as it goes from one container to the next. So in order to do that, we should use the same container,
mm-hmm.
so that we're not making a statement with those containers.
Because the first-time viewer will wonder if the container is what they're to be looking at, or the insides, or exactly what. Is that
exactly. Mm-hmm. You have hit it on the head, exactly. Mm-hmm. But these are so obvious, but not, again, it's obvious to the researcher because they have mentally edited out all the stuff that's extraneous, but the first-time viewer can't do that.
This is Bill Hammack, and I'm talking with Felice Frankel. She's a research scientist at MIT and has been called the Ansel Adams of scientific photography.
Who said that?
I saw that somewhere.
You're kidding.
I will dig it up for you.
Good God.
I think it's very, very apt. We're talking about her scientific photographs, which have appeared in Scientific American Discover magazine and have been exhibited at museums around the world. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL. If you're in the area or if you're anywhere else, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Well, one of your other rules for making a good photograph is very simple. It's look again. And
exactly.
What are some examples of things that changed in your photographs when you looked again?
Well, I think, I'm looking at one right now that I made an image of two kinds of yeast colonies. And the first time I made the picture, the light source was so powerful in the composition, not that you saw the light, but you saw what the light was doing, that the story became too complicated. It was too complex a story. Your eye did not go to the stuff that I wanted you to go to, and it was a mistake. In fact, as you know, the book, I'd have a lot of kind of before and after kind of images.
Mm-hmm. You're very brave to show your good photographs and your not so good ones.
Well, I think that's how we learn. Mm-hmm. That's how I learn anyway. And so, and actually, I'm surprised that I kept the lousy ones, but I'm delighted because I did finally have a book to write. But it's about looking carefully, looking again, and making sure, are we saying everything we need to say in this? Are we saying too much? See, this is what I find, for the most part, is the problem with most images that scientists take or most of the figures they make. There's just too much information. There's too much graphics. There are too many fonts. We've got to remember, once again, it's that first-time viewer that we're talking to, that they don't know how to look. We have to help them look. And by complicating it with so much stuff, they just have no clue where to look. So it's about looking and again and making sure we have the minimal amount that we need.
Mm-hmm. Felice, we have a caller on line four, so I would like to go right now to caller on line four. Please go ahead.
Hi, I'm from Pontiac.
Pontiac, Michigan?
No, Illinois.
Pontiac, Illinois. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And this is interesting. I would like to go back to your artist question for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an artist, and I think you probably are too, but I read a really wonderful quote once, which I won't be able to come up with, but it was a book you might enjoy reading if you could find it. It's long out of print. It's the lady's name was Nan Fairbrother, mm-hmm. and it was called An English Year. And she was an artist with a very scientific viewpoint, writing about during World War II, about being in England while the war was going on and all the things she observed in nature around her. And one of the things she said about artists that I just thought was interesting, related to what you said, was that the best art is art where we're trying to look at the world from our own viewpoint, not look at you just can't look at yourself or tell about yourself, that any one person isn't really interesting enough. But when the gift an artist has, which I think it sounds like you do with these pictures, is to show the world through your viewpoint.
Mm.
So by her definition, I think you'd be an artist.
Okay. No, that sounds very interesting. I accept that. You know this whole notion of whether it's art or not. That's it's really a kind of a way for us to talk about all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. In a way, I almost think it's not that important whether people think that this stuff is art or not. But I appreciate what you're saying, and I think it makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Well, thanks. And you might look for that book.
Can you say it again, please?
An English Year.
Okay.
It's called An English Year, and the lady was Nan Fairbrother.
Fairbrother, okay.
F-A-I-R-B-R-O-T-H.
Terrific. Thank you so much.
Wonderful read. Thank you.
You bet.
Felice, to move away from that question of an artist, one thing that you say you clearly aren't, and I'm using your own words here, you say you aren't fully trained, that's a quote, as a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
How does that give you an advantage, or is it a disadvantage of a practicing scientist for your work?
Right. It's double-edged. There's no question about it. I come in, the way this works is, in order for me to make anything really happen, I have to understand what it is I'm photographing or imaging. So I do sit down with the researcher. That's the very first step, and find out what they're trying to do. The non-training comes in nicely because I genuinely I get very excited, almost childlike, and that is it's something that the researcher really believes and should believe. And loves the questions because the questions are actually quite naive, also mm-hmm. childlike.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think if I were fully trained, I'd have the audacity to ask these very simple questions.
You might never have got started.
I would never have gotten, yeah. But although the thing that works in the fact that I've taken physics and chemistry and all that, that part is essential in the sense.